Podcast with your host Matthew M.
Hello and welcome to the Clean and Filthy Podcast, where we are clean and serene with the filthy mind in between. I am your host Matthew M, and I am an addict in recovery. We are very excited for our very first episode here of the Clean and Filthy Podcast. Huge thank you to everybody for all the support up to this point and everybody who's watching live on YouTube right now. We will be here every Tuesday, 5 p.m. Arizona time, live on YouTube with episodes available for download wherever you consume your podcast. So check us out on Spotify, Apple Podcasts. We're almost on Google Podcasts. They take a little bit longer to get there, as well as Stitcher and a bunch of other options there. So first off, got to say a huge thank you to everybody for all the support getting us here. Everybody's been so supportive, and you know, I really, really appreciate that. Have to say a special thank you to the people that really put in footwork to help get this process going. First off, Spencer P, Rochelle K, and also Renee S. Thank you all for all of the support and pushing this forward. Before we get any further, I got to give a shout out to our sponsor for this episode, which is Etc. by Emily. Again, thank you so much to our episode sponsor. If you are wanting any information about staffing agency for parties, events, or if you're looking for a job, check out her information in the description below. Also, really want to give a shout out to all of our VIP supporters. These are people who are paying on Patreon to help grow this channel. First, for tonight's episode, we've got Andrea R. and we've got Clint P. And both of you guys are going to get one of these awesome Clean and Filthy Podcast stickers. So make sure to send me your information so I can send it out to you. If you would like to be one of our VIP supporters and get a sticker, please head over to Patreon. All of the links for everything that I'm going to mention is all in the description below. So please go ahead and check that out. So before we really get into our segments here, I want to make sure to kind of give a little background of what we do here. You know, we are a 12-step recovery-based podcast. We're here to show that any addict can lose the desire to use, find a new way, and find a new way to live. That is truly our goal here. We are a community resource. We are a support group. We're a great opportunity to have people who maybe don't know anything about recovery or are confused about addiction or dealing with it in their families or, you know, all of those things. This is a great place to start, as we can, you know, all together give help and really carry the message. But what I do want to make sure to point out, what we are not. We are not a 12-step meeting. We are not here representing any 12-step fellowship. I will not be discussing my home group or my area or anything of that nature to make sure I don't conflict with the traditions of recovery. So at the end of the day, we are here, you know, to just show what can happen within recovery, show what, you know, experience, strength, and hope really is with a little bit of opinion. And really just carry the message. So if you're looking for a meeting or you're looking for treatment or sober living or any of those things, I would be more than happy to help you. But please contact me directly, either by going to Matthew@cleanandfilthypodcast.com or contacting me through social media, as this is not a, you know, endorsement or any kind of anything like that for any specific fellowship or any treatment center or anything like that. I just want to make sure that's very clear. I'm going to give my experience, strength, and hope as to what has worked for me in 12-step recovery. It doesn't matter what that 12-step recovery is. It's just what has worked for me. So again, just want to make sure that, that's super clear. But, you know, anybody who's out there that might have questions about recovery, questions about addiction, think maybe they're an addict. Maybe the party isn't a party anymore and they really want to figure out what to do next. You know, contact us directly. But this podcast is for everybody. Even if you don't have a substance issue, even if you've never used a drug before in your life, the beautiful thing about recovery is that it can be focused to any aspect of our lives. You know, not just the using of drugs and other controlled substances. So again, thank you everybody for being here. And we're going to go ahead and get right into our first segment, which is called R&D.
Let's head to the lab for some R&D. Recovery and development.
All right, we are in the lab for some R&D, recovery and development. This is the segment of our show where each week we're going to be discussing either a step, a tradition, a concept, or a spiritual principle within recovery. And really how that ties into life, you know, what it means, you know, when you first get clean, what it means when you're further in your recovery, you know, it really is the basis for everything within recovery. So since it's week one, we're going to start off with step one. And it says that we admitted that we were powerless over our addiction, that our lives had become unmanageable. And this was a very difficult thought for me to comprehend when I first was looking into recovery. Because as addicts, we're so good at denial, at manipulation, especially towards ourselves. You know, I knew towards the end that my life was very unmanageable. You know, getting arrested 7 times with 5 felony charges, being kicked out of every Walmart in the galaxy. Those are all definite signs of unmanageability. But the problem with being an addict, or maybe the beauty of being an addict, is that we're so good at manipulating and rationalizing. And when we do something for so long, it becomes the norm. And so even though there would be times that I could see something as unmanageable, in that moment, I could rationalize it as, no, I just got unlucky. I just got unlucky to get arrested for shoplifting at Walmart. My life isn't unmanageable, you know, and even if things are a little unmanageable, it definitely isn't because of my drug use. Again, denial is you know, so common. And it's one of the things that runs deepest in us addicts and in society as a whole, a lot of times, honestly. But that unmanageability piece, while it was so prevalent in my life and I couldn't comprehend it, also can show up in your life in other ways. You know, I talk about the fact that I stay in recovery because I don't have a drug problem. I have a me problem. Because if I had a drug problem, then I simply remove the drugs and I should be perfectly fine, right? Well, I can tell you with 3 years clean that that is not the case, that there are still many issues that I need to work through, many elements that can still bring unmanageability in my life if I don't focus on them and I don't put the work into them. So the unmanageability piece, you know, was difficult for me, but it became a lot more clear once I, you know, went to treatment and I had a little bit of clarity and I could look and see, you know, how ridiculous my life was. You know, I share it a lot. You know, my life consisted of nothing more than finding ways and means to get more. And, you know, even if you take away the legal issues, even if you take away the, you know, waking up on the floor of the local jail, even if you take away all of those aspects, there was nothing inside of me anymore. You know, my life was so consumed by this quest to get more that there wasn't anything else. So when I speak to unmanageability, it speaks to, you know, how life truly gets to the point where we can't do a normal life. We can't function as a normal human being. The only thing that we know how to do is find ways and means to get more. But as easy, I won't say easy, but as less challenging as it was to address and, you know, actually accept the unmanageability of my life, the powerless part, that was difficult for me. That was difficult for me because throughout my addiction, I was the type of addict who always said, you know, I don't have a problem. I have an issue with this substance. Or I could stop at any time. You know, I could stop at any time. And I would focus on the times when I was able to stop using one substance by using a bunch of other substances, or, you know, being able to stop by filling my life with something else, filling that void inside of me with something else. And I would look at that as evidence that, hey, I'm not powerless. I could stop at any time. From a very young age, I was always told that I could do whatever I wanted to do. And I think that kind of laid the groundwork for me to not believe that I was truly powerless. You know, I fought it and fought it and fought it and fought it so constantly, thinking that, you know, this time it's going to be different. Again, the denial of the facts, you know, thinking this time is going to be different. Something about, you know, my life, even though I'm doing the exact same things, this time is going to be different. And that speaks to the level of denial and the self-manipulation that I was putting myself through. You know, the belief that for some reason things were going to be different, even though I was doing nothing different. And we'll talk about that a lot more next week when we get into the second step. You know, it says that, you know, in our reading, it says that the core of our disease is obsession, compulsion, and total self-centeredness. And the obsession is that feeling of needing more, whatever it is. That doesn't just speak to drugs. That could speak to sex. That could speak to porn. That can speak to money. That could speak to food. That could speak to collectible toys. That innate desire inside of us to get more, to fill whatever it is that's missing inside of us. You know, and that took me a while to realize. That took a while even after the drugs were removed to realize how the disease of addiction can manifest itself in my life, whether it is from money or sex or being stagnant and wanting to do nothing but binge TV all day. You know, all those things are, you know, manifestations of my addiction coming out. And that's just really how it works. And then when you get to the compulsion aspect of it, the compulsion is using against your will. That is powerlessness in its essence. I can remember so many times in my active addiction where I literally said, I don't want to use this anymore. I don't want to do this. But I mean, I'm not going to throw it away, right? I'm not going to waste it. I'm not going to do something like that. So this will be the last time. And it was the last time until that next time. And then it was that last time again until that next time. And that pattern continued for years. You know, I realized that I had a problem, you know, probably about 7 years into my, you know, active addiction of about 10, 11 years. I knew I had a problem before that, but I wasn't willing to do anything about it. You know, it was after using very consistently for many years that I finally said, you know, I should try to do something about this. And that's where I did the manipulation of, well, it's not everything I have a problem with. It is this thing I have a problem with. So I just won't do this thing. I'm going to do all these other things, and that's okay. And in my mind, because I didn't have any experience with recovery and with a 12-step fellowship, in my mind, that was going to work. You know, I always believed that that was going to work. And compulsively, I would use again. I would always use again. You know, the only thing that has ever worked for me to gain any substantial clean time has been working a program of recovery. Nothing else has ever worked. And I've tried everything else. I've tried the substitution. I've tried the drug replacement. I've tried the geographical change. I've tried the new lovers. I've tried food. All of those things that I've tried in the past, nothing ever worked. Maybe I would get a little bit of relief from using, but I would never get relief inside. And that's what recovery is about, is making the changes within ourselves to get relief in our souls, in our essence. You know, I know for a fact if I wasn't using drugs, but I simply was abstinent, I wasn't in recovery, I know my life wouldn't be what it is today. I know that because I've done it. You know, I'm not speaking from some hypothesis. This is a hypothesis that I use scientific evidence to prove. And that's what I love so much about recovery, you know, is being able to find ways, healthy ways, to fight through that compulsion. Because that compulsion will drive us, will lead us time and time again back to whatever it is, whether it's a substance, whether it's an activity, whether it's a process addiction. If we don't do anything about it to change who we are, nothing's going to change. As they say, nothing changes if nothing changes. And simply abstaining from a substance or an activity doesn't equal change, because change leads to growth. And that's the beautiful thing, is being able to grow. And then we get to the last part of the obsession compulsion and total self-centeredness, which is that of total self-centeredness. And this is the core of addiction. And for some addicts, it manifests so much more obvious than others. Some addicts, are robbing people and getting their money and all those things. That's very obvious how self-centered it is. But for other people, the concept of self-centeredness is very difficult to grasp, especially when it comes to using. And I was one of those people as well who said, well, my addiction doesn't affect anybody. I can use. It doesn't do anything to anybody. But when we actually look back on it and realize the amount of damage and the amount of things that occurred that maybe I didn't even ever realize, that level of self-centeredness was astronomical. And it's a very common trait within most addicts. If you're an addict and you're sitting there right now saying, I was never self-centered, keep coming back. Because I would guess that through some step work, through some, work in the program, elements of self-centeredness will come up. Because inherently, it's almost impossible to be an addict without being self-centered. Because if I'm focusing on other people's needs, if I'm not putting myself first and foremost at all the times, how am I continuing my drug addiction career? It doesn't work. It doesn't work unless I'm keeping myself at the absolute focus to get one more, to find ways and means to get one more. That is the only way that, we're able to sustain our addiction. So the level of self-centeredness that we feel a lot of times isn't apparent. A lot of times it takes effort and work and step work and talking with other addicts. Sometimes, outside work. When I say outside work, I'm speaking of going to therapy or something outside of a 12-step fellowship to really understand those things that have been fueling our addiction for so long. But the key to all of these things within the first step is surrender. And that's a very weird concept for a lot of people. Anybody who has ever played sports, growing up, it's you never quit. You never surrender. You fight until the end. I'm sure anybody who's been in the military, which thank you all for your service. If you're listening to this and you're in the military, thank you for your service. But anybody who has been in any kind of regimented sort of situation like that, quitting is never an option. Quitting is not something that you do. And it's so funny where truly that is the way that you succeed in recovery, is by waving that white flag and surrendering. It's the main reason why in any fellowship, the first key tag that you get is white, the international color of surrender. That is the statement of, I am a newcomer. I am brand new here. Help me. Please help me. And that's difficult. That's difficult for a lot of people, myself included. That realization that I can't do it on my own, that realization that I'm not able to control my using or control my acting out, that realization that this isn't all in my control, in my power, the fact that I need help, that was a very, very difficult thing for me and took a very, very long time. I was very close to my bottom of active addiction for probably about 2 years. And every single time I would think, okay, I need to stop. The concept of treatment was never an option in my mind, because that was quitting. That was saying I couldn't do it on my own. But let's look at the evidence. I couldn't do it on my own. You know, so if you're out there and you're struggling and you're like, I can't go to treatment. Only weak people go to treatment. That's a lie that we tell ourselves to, again, manipulate our brains, to allow us to live in denial, to allow us to simply continue using. But I'm here to tell you that we don't have to do that anymore. We don't have to live that way. You know, when we can come into the program and we can truly surrender to the program and to the fact that we are addicts, a beautiful thing happens. You know, a beautiful thing happens. We gain a freedom. The first step, it says in the literature, the first step means we no longer have to use. And that is the ultimate freedom. That is the ultimate freedom, is that we no longer have to use. Even if we want to, we don't have to. You know, we don't have to. And that gift of desperation is what really led to my surrender. I finally got to the point where I was so broken. I was so broken, I couldn't do it anymore. I didn't, and it wasn't even from a spiritual perspective as I was so broken. It was from a perspective of, I didn't have any other means. I didn't have anybody else to manipulate. I didn't have anything else to steal. I didn't have anybody else to lie to or con or connive. I couldn't get fronts from anybody anymore. I had gotten to the point where there was no other option. And finally, I said, okay, I'll accept help. And that was the best decision I have ever made in my life, was actually being willing to accept help. And sadly, you know, there are people, I'm sure there are people listening to you saying, wow, I wish this person would go to treatment, or I wish this person would just give it a try. They're an addict. Well, the thing about being an addict is that nobody can tell us we're an addict. It has to come from within. It has to be an admission that we make. And that is such a powerful admission. It's such a powerful admission to actually state, I'm an addict and I need help. And that's what the fellowship is there to do. You know, we say constantly, what I can't do alone, we can do together. And I completely, full-heartedly believe that, because it's been working in my life, just like it's been working in the lives of millions of addicts around the world. You know, and it says in our literature, it says, when we could no longer stand our old ways, we began to change. From that point forward, every day is a successful day, no matter what happens. And I truly believe that. I truly believe that if it weren't for that final just surrender and that final just couldn't take it anymore, I know I wouldn't be where I was. You know, people say all the time, you know, well, what was your bottom? What was your bottom? Oh, your bottom wasn't that bad. Or, oh, your bottom was horrible. It doesn't matter. For me, my bottom was when I stopped digging. My bottom was when I stopped digging and I accepted help. And I realized that no matter how smart I thought I was, no matter how capable I thought I was, no matter how amazing I thought I was, I couldn't do this alone. I couldn't. And I still can't. With 3 years clean, I know I cannot do this alone. And COVID has definitely put some strains on that at times. But I know to my core, I cannot do this alone. I can only do it with the help of the fellowship, with the help of a higher power. Something else we'll get into tomorrow. I'm sorry, next week, when we start discussing the second step. But my favorite line in the first step reading, it says, we are not responsible for our disease, but we are responsible for our recovery. And that's a profound thing, because all of the things I did, the shame, the guilt, the feelings of inadequacy, feelings of less than, the truly vile things that I did in my addiction, I'm not responsible for that, but I am responsible to grow from it. I am responsible for my recovery. You know, if I simply say, oh, well, I was an addict, all that's forgiven, whatever, and I don't do any kind of work, then nothing changes. Again, nothing changes if nothing changes. You know, I believe inside that while we aren't responsible for our disease, if we don't do anything for our recovery, then we didn't make a change. We didn't make a choice to do better, to grow. So in a way, I almost feel like then I would be responsible for what I did, even though the literature says we aren't. But that's my personal opinion. There's the first little instance of, you know, not just experience, strength, and hope. That's my personal opinion there. And that's something I don't want to go back to. You know, I don't want to go back to feeling guilty for the things I did. I don't want to get back to feeling guilty for the pain I caused. I want to continue making strides forward by working the steps, by being an active member in the fellowship, so that I'm able to have that responsibility. And it's a great feeling, you know, getting back into life and getting responsibility and being a responsible member of humanity. But for me, my biggest responsibility is my recovery. You know, we always talk about that we have to keep our recovery first, because anything we put in front of our recovery, we will lose. And I fully believe that. And so my biggest responsibility is to my recovery. By doing the work, by putting the pen to paper, by being of service, by having a home group, by having a sponsor, by going to meetings and contributing to meetings. Those are the things that I do by to take responsibility for my recovery. And that's for me personally. I know people out there who, you know, don't do all those five things, and that's how they take responsibility for the recovery. But for this addict, the things I need to do are what I just listed. I need to go to meetings. I need to have a sponsor. I need to work steps. I need to have a home group, and I need to be of service. That's what works for me. And that's how I take my responsibility for my recovery, because nobody's going to do it for me. Nobody's going to do it for me. I have to do this for myself. I'm not doing it for my son. I'm not doing it for my parents. I'm not doing it to get a better job or to get a hot girlfriend or to be a multi-billionaire. I'm not doing it because a judge told me to, or, you know, any of those things. I'm doing it because for myself, I want to be a better person. I don't want to be the person that I was for multiple, multiple years, hating life. I went through my life, you know, shameful of the past, terrified of the future, and hating the present. And that's not a way to live. You know, I want to be responsible for my recovery so that I'm able to live the life that I'm creating within recovery. You know, and that's a huge thing for me. So, you know, if you're new, if this all sounds like gibberish to you, if this all sounds just completely off the wall and makes no sense at all, that's fine. Keep coming back. Reach out to somebody. Ask them about their first step. Ask them about their surrender. Ask them about their need to constantly surrender. For me personally, I have to surrender constantly. Constantly. And that's not from a drug-related perspective. That's from a life-related perspective. I have to surrender to the fact that I am an addict. And that if I do that one thing one time, I know where that's going to lead. I know where that's going to lead. So hopefully that's some fun time in the lab there. Like I said, this is going to be a weekly segment. Each week, we're going to be going through a different step, tradition, concept. Once we get through those, we're going to start doing some spiritual principles and just some other kind of topics within, you know, within recovery that are pretty pressing in life. So next segment, we're going into my favorite moment of the week. And this is where we go through different things that have happened in the last 7 days and, you know, what I feel about them and how, you know, and this doesn't have to be recovery related. This might be, you know, something simply, I saw a meme I really liked. So, chance for a plug. If you're not following Clean and Filthy Podcast on Instagram, please go out, follow, I'll follow you back, and then send me cool memes. I love some dank recovery memes, because this will be an opportunity for that, or, you know, whatever's going on. There were a few things I wanted to talk about. My character defect of ego wanted me to say my favorite moment of the week was getting 3 years clean. It was not. I also almost had a late entry in this segment last night because I watched Judas and the Black Messiah. And it was incredibly well done. Go check it out. Lakeith Stanfield, I love you, bro, but I hate you as well. Shout out also, when is Atlanta coming back? Amazing show. Shout out Donald Glover. Love that show. But what we're going to talk about in this segment is something that it technically happened more than 7 days ago. But, you know, first episode, we didn't have a in the last week type of time constraint on this. We're just going with what was a big moment in my mind. So we're going to talk about the weekend's performance at the Super Bowl, which personally I thought was absolutely phenomenal. Gotta put a little asterisk here. I am a huge Weeknd fan, huge EXO fan. And we're going to get into a little level of that regarding recovery as well. But when I went online and I saw all of the incredible memes, some of those, like the memes showing his face as he's inside the mirror room and saying, this is what it's like whenever, you know, a kid takes your phone, spot on, solid, solid memeage regarding the Weeknd's performance. But then I started seeing the negative responses to it. And this was weird for me. This was weird for me because I thought it was an amazing performance. I thought it was a great production. Even if I take the fact that I love The Weeknd and I love his music and I've been, you know, supporting him, humble brag, since his first mixtape came out and was released by Drake well before House of Balloons even came out. Sorry, ego came out there. But when I saw how many people were completely split on this, and there weren't many people who were like, oh, it was all right. It was like people either loved it, Abel's the best, Weeknd forever, OVO for life, he's the greatest, or it was, that was trash. There really wasn't an in-between. Now, that brings a lot of thoughts in my mind. So, of course, first I had to ask, you know, some other people who aren't even Weeknd fans, what did you think of the performance? And the people I spoke to, I got the same feeling that I did. Maybe not quite to the same levels because I'm a super, you know, Weeknd fan.
That part.
Yeah. But they still were saying it was amazing. It was an amazing show. It was a great show. But when I went online and I saw how many people were just undermining it and saying it was trash, it was trash, it didn't make sense to me. So I started talking to some people and looking at it a little bit, you know, deeper. And what kind of came out to me was I was curious. Is it the element that it was unlike any show that we've seen recently? And what I'm saying, just look at the scenery, if you will, for The Weeknd's performance compared to the prior year of J-Lo and Shakira. What do you notice? You notice that there's not a copious amount of women wearing very little clothing. And now I'm not up here to shame anybody who loves beautiful women on TV. I love beautiful women on TV. But the fact of the matter is that within society, and within any kind of, you know, music, film, women are expected to be provocative, expected to be sexy, instead of just being able to go out there and just show their talent. And there are obviously exceptions to this. You know, there are exceptions. But the vast majority of pop culture, of, you know, world celebrity singers are going to be showing that element off. And so it was interesting to me, and this is how my brain works, but it was interesting to me because then I started thinking, maybe did people dislike The Weeknd show so much because it was so different, because they're trained mentally to think, hey, there should be hot women on stage wearing almost nothing, shaking their asses. Is that where our brains are wired because of it being, you know, shoved down our throats in the media, because of it being, you know, shown that that's what, you know, women in entertainment do. And so it was an interesting thing for me to look at, because for me personally, when I was going through, and I will admit, I got into a couple back and forths on Facebook, the thing that you never do, because talk about pointless, like arguing with somebody you don't even know on Facebook. There are better uses of my time, but I am such a Weeknd fan. I did that. I'm ashamed about that, but whatever. And one of the things that they kept saying was, well, really, that was better than J-Lo and Shakira? And I said, to me, yes, personally, it was. This was a show with one of my favorite singers who sounded about as good as anybody sounds on the Super Bowl, who made the best of what he could with the pandemic. You know, there was a different vibe. You know, there weren't fans on the field and it wasn't center, you know, at the 50-yard line. And so it was definitely a different vibe. But even if I remove my, you know, over-the-top EXO fandom, it still, to me, was amazing. It still, to me, was an amazing show. And when I look at it, it was like, it wasn't a bunch of like 70-year-old rock stars being like wheeled out onto the stage and propped up with sticks. It wasn't copious, you know, ass shaking or tons of celebrity cameos just for the sake of the stardom. You know, like, oh, let's just throw Beyonce on the stage for, you know, 30 seconds. Oh, let's throw Travis Scott on the stage for 30 seconds. It was one artist who believed in his craft, who performed for free and paid $7 million of his own money to give as good a show as possible, playing songs that I liked and didn't have to rely on women, you know, gyrating or undermine the talent inherently that he has or that any of these people have. Like, I think J-Lo and Shakira have talent. I'm not saying they don't, but the fact that we live in a culture where it's expected that for a woman to showcase her talent, she's got to be in a flesh-colored bodysuit. Shakira's got to get up there and hip shake until an earthquake starts. Like, that to me doesn't seem right. And again, I don't have the answers. I don't know. I'm just speaking what my favorite moment of the week was. So that's just, for me personally, something that, you know, was a very interesting element to it. It was a very interesting element to see the amount of hate over something that I thought was very well done. And every time when I try to ask him, like, so what didn't you like about it? Oh, it was boring. I don't see what was boring about that. But again, I'm a weekend stan. So, you know, it was amazing. The fact that he played a song off of House of Balloons, that was everything to me. I even said beforehand, I was like, just please, just let him play one song off of House of Balloons. I'll be happy. But this leads us into an interesting element when it comes to recovery. Because The Weeknd's record label is called EXO Records. And what does that stand for, you ask? It stands for Ecstasy and Other Drugs. The Weeknd's entire catalog is full of nothing but drugs and love and heartbreak and cheating and drugs and more heartbreak and cheating and really nice car references and cheating and drugs and more drugs. So it's very difficult as an addict in recovery who wants to show a life in recovery. It can be difficult at times when one of my favorite artists is so entrenched within drugs. And that's difficult from both perspectives, because most of my two favorite genres of music are hip hop and EDM. And hip hop was bred on drugs, and EDM is bred on drugs. So it can be a very interesting thing to be a supporter of somebody, you know, to be, you know, one of my favorite songs by The Weeknd is all about doing cocaine. Like, and I'm sitting there singing along to it, because that's something that works within me. I know people personally within the program who cannot listen to music from their using, cannot listen to music that is focused on drugs, cannot listen to, you know, something that they immediately are triggered back to that point. For me personally, you know, that thankfully isn't my story. There are certain things, there are certain songs that are much more difficult at times. Or I wouldn't even say more difficult, but they will pop a little something in my head. It'd be like, oh, remember this? Kid Cudi's first album, Man on the Moon. That's one of those things that I haven't gone back through and listened to all the way since I've been in recovery. I've listened to a couple songs here and there because that was one of my go-to songs when me and Molly would go hang out, Ecstasy, just in case anybody isn't familiar with that. And I just play that song, I mean, that album, and on repeat and, you know, whatever. So that's something that I personally have had to make a little bit of a change to. But when I'm listening to Mask Off by Future and Kendrick, I'm sitting there saying Percocet, Molly Percocet, because for me, I'm okay with doing that. But I know a lot of people who aren't. But it's different when it's an artist that I really like. I don't like Future. He's trash. You can at me all you want. He's trash. But I love that song. And I love a lot of songs by a lot of people that have a lot of drug use involved. And it can be difficult. It can be difficult to separate that element of it. It can be difficult to say, I support this person's music, even if I don't support his life choices or even if I worried about his life choices. And The Weeknd's even said, you know, drugs have been a crutch for him before. He's flat out said that this is the, he's pretty much said all the things that addicts say without saying that he has a problem and that he's addicted, though he did admit to being addicted to work. So again, the disease of addiction, it's not just about drugs, for the record. But, you know, he's come out and said that, you know, he still uses some, but he never performs. He said he always performs sober and tries not to be drinking either. So take that for what it is. But when I'm wearing his shirt and then I'm talking to somebody about recovery, that can be an interesting, you know, and I'll admit personally, I don't wear The Weeknd's clothes to meetings. I don't wear The Weeknd's clothes if I'm on a Zoom meeting. And for some people, they might be listening to saying, that's stupid. Who cares? He's just an artist. But to other people, I'm sure there's somebody out there who gets that because it's not something that they're probably doing something similar. And that can be very challenging. I had a sponsee who, you know, flat out, he used to be involved in a music scene very deeply, and he cannot do that anymore. That was his livelihood, and he cannot make music anymore because of the effects that it has on his recovery. You know, I've seen it time and time again, especially in the SoundCloud world of the Lils. So many people who are, you know, idolizing Lil Peep or Lil Xan or, you know, all these Lils. I don't know a lot of them, not because I'm old, because again, trash, but they're internalizing them to such a point that they want to be them and they want to be a SoundCloud rapper, but they want to be in recovery. And time again, continue to go back to that thought process and that livelihood and sadly go back out. So that element is a difficult thing, that keeping it separate between entertainment and, you know, recovery and where they cross over and finding out what works for you personally. For me personally, I'm going to be rocking my XO shirt. I'm going to be, you know, listening to House of Balloons, and I'm going to be enjoying the songs that Abel made when he was most intoxicated. He admits that like on his first album, my favorite songs, which are the ones that are like 5+ minutes long, are all because he was so high that he didn't have any kind of idea as to what he wanted to do with the song. So he just went with it. But it also really brings up an interesting thing with the amount of drugs that are promoted. You know, it's so difficult to want to support something that is antithetical to the way I live my life. And obviously how I live my life isn't how everybody else is going to live their life. You know, everybody else is going to make their own choices and their own, you know, whatever it is. But I almost feel internally some element of like, I'm not carrying recovery properly by supporting artists that, you know, condone or, you know, glamorize drug use. This is a topic that I'm sure we will talk about a lot more. But you know, that to me was my favorite moment of the week. We went all over the place with that, but The Weeknd's performance at the Super Bowl was fire. If anybody tells you otherwise, they're wrong.
That part.
All right. Now it is time for our next segment.
It's time to ask an addict with your host, Matthew N.
That's right. It is time to ask an addict. This is the portion of our show where we answer different questions that viewers have submitted, different questions that I've been asked personally, you know, and just kind of give my perspective on it. You know, I am an addict. So this is, again, my opinion. This isn't, you know, fellowship approved, anything like that. This is just my personal opinion on a lot of things. I will go back to my experience, strength, and hope as well, but there's a lot of elements of my opinion in here. So if you want to ask a question for this podcast, please go to our website, www.cleanandfilthypodcast.com. Go to the contact tab and submit your question to us. Again, it does not have to be recovery related at all. It can be anything. Think of this kind of like a Reddit AMA, ask me anything. You know, it's just fun to answer questions. I don't know why. I love answering people's questions, obviously about recovery, but in general as well. So first question that I got was, what was my drug of choice, or DOC? And I don't really want to focus on that too much because, you know, one of the biggest things within the fellowship is finding unity and finding, you know, similarities, not our differences. So I don't want to focus on that too much. And somebody who's listening, you know, be like, oh, well, that wasn't me. But I will say that, you know, my addiction progressed from legal, well, they weren't legal at the time that I started them, but legal options to options that are now legal in the state of Arizona, and escalated from there. And it's an interesting thing because, you know, we talk about the disease of addiction being progressive, and it truly was, you know, it truly was so progressive from the smallest little thing to the next thing, to this, to that, to the next. And it got to the point where I'll say that I went to treatment for my addiction to opiates. That was my main reason that I went to treatment. But during that time, I used pretty much everything. You know, a lot of people in the program talk about, you know, my drug of choice was more. When people would first say that, I used to think I was kind of corny. But when I really look at that, a lot of that really rings true within my story. Because if I couldn't get what I wanted and you had that, okay, cool, let's go. You know, I will say, like, my drug of choice was everything. And different times in my life, at certain times in my life, this substance might have been my drug of choice, you know, but then when I was raving a lot, then this was my drug of choice. And then when I was hanging out in the club a lot, then this was my drug of choice. But the one thing that was always consistent in some element was my use of opiates. And so that's what I would say I went to treatment for. I can't really say, you know, what my true DOC, like, from that perspective, because it really kind of was more, as corny as that sounds. And it's interesting, the longer I've been in recovery, the less that we talk about our drug of choice. I know when I first came in the rooms, that was like the first thing you ask somebody, like, oh yeah, how much time you got? Oh yeah, what was your drug of choice? And now it's to the point where it really doesn't matter, because whatever we use to fill that hole in our soul, as my sponsor says, that it doesn't matter if it was liquid, if it was greenery, if it was injected, smoked, snorted, put up your butt, whatever. It doesn't matter at the end of the day. You know, the same thing that's afflicting you is afflicting me, regardless of what the substance is. And that's why recovery is such a possible thing, because we find those commonalities. We find those similarities between us and, you know, how they work and how we can recover together from them. So that's kind of the answer for my drug of choice. As corny as it sounds, I will say more, because it was always more and more and more. Next question that we had was submitted on Facebook, and it says, how integrated should religious bodies be in recovery programs? I guess this is something that, he said that in his area, there are a lot of groups that are really rejecting any kind of organized religion platform. And one thing I will say is that any program is not a religious program. It is a spiritual program. And that can become difficult, because in certain meetings, they recite the Lord's Prayer. In all fellowship meetings, they talk about God, of a God of our understanding. They talk about Him with a capital H. You know, they always have those elements. So it can be difficult to say, oh, this isn't religious, but now I'm seeing God written, you know. And this is something we're going to talk about a lot more next week when we get into the element of, you know, our higher power in the second step. But I think that it's really important to remember that any fellowship is a spiritual program, not a religious program. Are there, you know, meetings out there that are probably super religious? Yeah, there probably are. Is it weird that a lot of meetings are in church basements, or at least before, you know, COVID? I mean, I guess it's kind of difficult to be sitting in a church basement and somebody saying, oh, this is a spiritual program, not a religious program, and looking at the cross on the wall. But true, this is a program about whatever works for us. And again, I don't want to get into too much about higher power stuff, because we're going to talk about that next week. That's going to be our part in recovery and development. But for me, I feel like religion shouldn't be involved at all. But that's going to be a difficult thing, because using the word God doesn't have to be religious. The problem is that most people, myself included, why I struggled so much with the second step, is that when I saw the word God, I automatically associated that with religion. I automatically, you know, because I stopped reading the second step. Again, I'm getting into this. But I stopped reading where it said God, not as we understood him. You know, I'm sorry, it doesn't need to be an almighty Judeo-Christian God. It's whatever works for us. So having elements of religion built into the fellowships, it makes sense. It makes sense when you look at, you know, the fellowship, when one of the fellowships first started, it was, you know, back in the 20s. I think it was 28, 29. And then when one of the other big ones started, it was in 1953. And in those times, religion was much more ingrained within the country as a whole. You know, it was much more of a go-to. It, you know, not being religious was the anomaly. It wasn't the norm. Where I feel like now we're getting much more of a perspective that religiosity isn't as much the norm as it once was. So that's kind of the element with that. We'll talk about that a lot more in the next 2 weeks with step two and step three. The next question is, why is this podcast live? Again, anybody who's listening right now to this podcast in the not live version, we record this live every single week at 5 p.m. Arizona time. We are live on YouTube right now. And then this podcast will now be uploaded afterwards to all of the major streaming, all the major platforms for podcasts, as well as if you want to go back and watch the video as well, it'll be on YouTube. And the reason that I did this was because I feel there's some element to being live. I feel there's a level of authenticity, a level of honesty with being live. You know, to me, that gives something character. I don't want to hear a podcast that's perfectly smooth, that there's no mistakes, that the host didn't say 15 times in the first three sentences because he was nervous. I like that level of authenticity. For me, I would rather watch a show that maybe doesn't have quite as good of information on it, but seems authentic, more than a show that seems like a big budget Hollywood production, personally. So that's why I like the live element. I also like I've really gotten into Twitch lately. And so I follow a lot of live streams and it's fun using this OBS software and having transitions and having little buttons
that
I can push on my stream deck. That's fun to me. And, you know, one thing that we always talk about is, you know, do something that's fun to you. If you can find a job that, you know, is fun, you don't work a day in your life. So this is an element of fun for me. You know, I want to be able to help and I want to be able to carry the message, but I also want to have fun. I have fun in recovery. And this is one of the ways that I do. So that's the main reason why we're live. Anybody who's listening to this and not listening to it live, come and check us out. Like I said, on YouTube every single Tuesday, 5 p.m. And yeah, I just feel there's a level of authenticity within that. Because if this wasn't live, I would have cut that, refilmed it, cut it again, refilmed it, spliced it together, and then put out a super shiny product. That's just not my vibe. Anybody who knows me knows that I like the level of authenticity. I like the true excitement about being live, the nervousness. My hands were shaking so much when we started. Well, I don't know if you could tell, but when I held this picture up, my hand was doing this because, you know, that's a feeling of excitement. And I love that feeling of excitement. And I love feeling that excitement being clean because for so long I was so numb, I didn't even really feel nervous. The only time I felt nervous is when I got pulled over. When I got pulled over and I knew I was sitting on a felony and was wondering if I was going to end up in jail. That's really the only time I got nervous, you know, and now I get to feel nervous. I get to feel emotions. I get to walk through them and share that with you guys. Share that with people, you know, that maybe are, you know, struggling with certain things themselves. So that's why we're live here. That is the reason that I think this is a fun avenue and a fun way to do this. So We're going to do one last segment before we close up for the day. And this is our clean time shout outs. These are for anybody who has celebrated one of the universally recognized milestones within the program. So that's for a newcomer, which is anybody with 29 days or less. If you have 30 days clean, if you have 60 days clean, if you have 90 days clean, if you have 6 months clean, 9 months clean, 18 months, a year clean, sorry, 18 months clean, or multiple years of recovery. We also are going to throw some other elements in there. So if you have 100 days, if you have 200 days, 250, any like solid big number, because we have to remember that every single day clean is a miracle. And we need to really be excited about that. You know, that's why I love doing clean time so much. That's like my favorite part in a meeting is seeing people get time. So if you want to be recognized, if you have celebrated a clean time milestone, one of the, you know, normally recognized ones, or as I said, the little Clean and Filthy podcast twist of 100 days, 500 days, 1,000 days, any of those things, make sure to send me a message. Again, www.cleanandfilthypodcast.com. And let me know what your first name is, your last initial, and how much time you are celebrating so I can give you a shout out. So first off, celebrating 6 months clean, we got my boy Rhodey. You get a half a boop, my man. And next up, we've got Marcy with 1 year clean. Boop. We do bups for each year, just in case anybody's not familiar. Just keep that in mind. And lastly, and definitely not most importantly, because, you know, I have to remember that at the end of the day, I couldn't do this. We did this. Myself, Matthew M., I am an addict, and I have 3 years clean as of yesterday. Boop, boop, boop. So I'm pretty hyped about that. That's pretty cool. But with that, first episode is officially done. I want to give a huge thank you to everybody for being with us today. I really appreciate it. I appreciate all the support. Please like, comment, subscribe on all the channels of social media. Get us out there and join us next week at 5 p.m. Again, have to say a huge thank you to Valentino Khan, Alice in Wonderland, and Mad Decent Records for giving us the permission to use this amazing track, Anything, as our theme music. Links to download in the description below. I love each and every one of you. Nobody's told you that. I love you.